Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. Last week we did a review of the wars. This week we're going to sort of look at a review of last year on how to make war. Jim, when did you write the original How to Make War?
1981. So I believe it was published in early 82 or something around there.
So we're coming up on 30 years on that. And I think one of the surprising things about the book, and I found this interesting when I watch journalists now when they're interviewed in their offices and like that, especially those correspondents covering the war, you can look up on their shelf and you'll usually see a copy of How to Make War up on the up on their bookshelf.
Surprisingly, a large source of sales was the military itself, and at first that surprised me. I mean, I'd go to conferences down in D.C. and I have a general come up and shake my hand and say, hey, that was a great book, and I'd wonder, I'd smile, you know. Then an admiral come up, and then a marine would come up. Finally, I got up the nerve to ask. I said, well, hey, you're in the military. He said, and the Army guy said, yeah, but I never really understood what those guys in the Navy and the Air Force were doing. So they had both a professional interest and a lack of information to deal with, and it worked out very well. Journalists, of course, were the other, you know, huge audience, which is why it shows up on the background in TV shots frequently.
Right. Now, you are working on a review that we'll publish on Strategy Page here within the next week or so.
Tomorrow morning.
Tomorrow morning, okay. And I saw sort of a preview of it, and I want to jump down to my two favorite topics, and that.
Oh, by the way, this is the top How to Make War, you know, military developments of last year.
Right, exactly. And my two favorite topics are electronic warfare and information warfare. And my favorite thing about the electronic warfare that's been going actually on since the Iraq War started is the use of cell phones.
Yes, but this, you know, this use of telephones in on the battlefield, I don't know if we ever mentioned this in Strategy Page or even How to Make War. It's been going on since World War II. The troops, I mean, the walkie-talkie first appeared in World War II, and it was about the size of one of those 1980, a brick, about the size of those 1980 cell phones. And the troops loved it, even though it had shitty reception, had a range of maybe a mile if you were lucky. But at the end of World War II, when they got into Germany, those efficient Germans, their telephone systems, the landlines, were robust enough to keep operating even when there was battle going on. So the Americans got to that custom of when they were approaching a town that appeared to be defended, they just get a local phone number over there and they call up the Germans, say, and discuss, you know, maybe they should ought to surrender and not keep fighting. In the invasion of Grenada, there was another famous incident where American troops had lost their wireless communications, I mean, which can be lost for any number of reasons, you know, the atmosphere, or if you're using FM, something gets in the way. And they had to call in an airstrike, and one guy realized he had a credit card, telephone. He found a payphone that would take credit cards, which was a relatively new innovation back in the 80s. And so he called back to Washington and said, hey, I'm here with the umpteenth, you know, whatever, it was 82nd Airborne, and we need an airstrike real fast, and I can't get through, and could you patch us through so we can get an airstrike? And it took him a little longer, but he managed to call in the airstrike using a payphone. Naturally, once everybody got cell phones and they got onto battlefields, be it Iraq, which got cell phone service real quick after Saddam went, and Afghanistan, which has gotten it big time in the last 5 years, the troops would take their cell phones out there. Now, you're not supposed to use them, even though they have pretty good encryption, the ones they use in every place except the United States. But the troops found, especially with the smartphones, that there was a lot of things they could do with the damn phone, even though it wasn't, technically speaking, a battlefield instrument. And, of course, as we mentioned in the piece that'll show up tomorrow, the Army forced, I think, more by, you know, the uproar at the bottom, as it were, that maybe it'd be a good idea to get a military cell phone out there. The Army, this is a piece we'll probably run next week, they just bought several thousand of, I forget the nomenclature. It looks like a cell phone, but it isn't. Basically, it's a handheld, you know, phone using typical military communications. And it's being given to non-U.S. troops so that they can communicate with each other, you know, NATO, Afghan, what have you. But this phone, this handheld radio, really, it's a walkie-talkie that looks like a cell phone, will also communicate with American radio networks. The only thing, it's encrypted, the only thing you need is the special code, depending on what network you want to get into. So this is the impact of the cell phone on the battlefield. And it really came to a head, so to speak, last year, as we reported several times, you know, in earlier pieces during the course of 2010.
Yeah, I think the one I liked the best that we reported on was the, I think it was an iPhone app for snipers.
Oh, that I think was not 2009. That came out early. The iPhone, you know, the iPhone app for snipers. And of course, there's several of them out there now. But the big thing we did in 2010, that early article, was the one on rats. Raytheon decided to take an Android phone and on their own nickel, realizing, you know, perhaps listening to the troops more than the generals did, that there was a huge demand for this. And so now they are in the lead, as it were, in the competition to be the you know, the actual, you know, official you know, military cell phone.
Huh. Austin, when you were in Iraq and when you did your tour, your civilian tour in Afghanistan, what sort of things did you see the phone being used for?
Well, look, you know, I was only there. I've been in Afghanistan twice, but both for short periods of time. You know, I worked over there as a journalist. Well, I'll tell you what I used mine for. And when I was on my trip to Afghanistan, and then the trip I made back to Iraq as a civilian in 2005. That's how I lined up all my interviews. It permitted me to be. In Afghanistan, I wasn't quite in the middle of nowhere, but they had cell phone service all up and down the highway. I noticed made a highway connecting Bagram and Kabul. It allowed me to carry on my own one-man global operation there in my pocket. Now, that, here I am contacting either the syndicate. I think I actually called you once, Dan, from the Middle East. It gives me the ability to roam, and as long as I've got cell service, I'm in contact. Now, I know we're talking about the military focus. We'll focus on this. But look, that's when I was in East Africa in 2002, all in Kenya, in Nairobi, and then in Kampala, in Uganda, everybody's got a cell phone. Now, when I'm back in the outback, up in West Nile province, all I did, well, I would run into people constantly telling me that they thought the future would be there in West Nile province like it was back in Kampala as soon as they had cell phones. I mean, it was a great deal of demand. Now, on strategy page, we have written about the ubiquity of cell phones in Iraq and how much, in Afghanistan, how much Afghans like them, and how the Taliban goes around blowing up cell towers. That's not a new report. That's at least 4 years, three or four years old, because it puts people in contact with one another. Now, I'll answer about Iraq. I had my own cell phone issued to me on Iraqinet, I think is the way it was. And, oh, yeah, it would work. I could call other Americans, but when I had their cell number, but we had all kinds of constant interruptions. Those, however, were just basic. Gee, I don't even know who made it. They were just a very basic cell phone. What Jim's been writing about is essentially putting computers with encryption and the like in the hands of soldiers to be able to have not just an alternative, but a regular means of both lateral communication and hierarchical communication.
Yeah. Well, let's move up to something bigger for a minute, naval power. The interesting thing there, Jim, U.S. Navy getting smaller, smaller ships, smaller forces, and China getting bigger.
Well, the Navy, U.S. and the Chinese Navy have the same problem. Although costs of building ships, warships, is somewhat cheaper in China, when you get into the high-tech area, it's still pretty expensive. So the Chinese are not talking about building a big fleet. What they're doing, basically, is replacing what is, in effect, a Cold War-era fleet. Early Cold War. I mean, some of their ships are possibly ancient and barely functional. With austere, modern warships. Nothing as fancy as it were as American warships, but modern. And by Chinese standards, fairly expensive. I mean, their budget is right now maybe 20-25% of the American defense budget. So they, relatively speaking, have a lot less money to spend on warships. But they're simply trying to modernize. Which, makes them more dangerous, depending on how close you get. And with their new J-20 stealth aircraft, that thing has, carrier killer written all over it, because they really have no other target for it. That's because, in fact, there's a piece that may run tomorrow on that. The big problem with the J-20 is the electronics. Although the Chinese make a lot of electronics, most of it's consumer grade. It's a step for them up to, a military grade, high end military grade electronics. But as the Russians like to point out, they even have a hard time copying, reverse engineering Russian military electronics, most of which is still stuck, at the end of the Cold War, in the 1990s, so to speak. Over time, the Chinese will overcome that, but in the near term, next 5 years, you're not going to see any Chinese aircraft, ruling the air. And the Chinese Navy simply wants to, for example, control the smuggling that still goes on around China. They're building a lot of new patrol boats because a lot of the old ones, they can't go to sea anymore because they leak, the engines are just can't get fixed anymore. And they simply want to control their sea borders. Their offensive capability is a ways off, but you don't get that sense because the mass media likes to play every new Chinese weapon as the end of the U.S. Navy as we know it. The U.S. Navy is shrinking simply because, just like they've been talking about the Air Force, ultimately shrinking to one airplane in the 22nd century, because the individual ships or aircrafts keep getting more expensive. And the Navy is coping with that as best they can. We ran a piece today about, the serious consideration. I got that information from the inside, as it were. People are arguing in the halls of the Pentagon about smaller carriers and how the hell we're going to afford, more of the CVN-21, the USS-4, the new class of nuclear carriers. You got to do something. The Air Force had to stop building, F-22s. They've already cut back the planned buy of F-35s once. They're now, again, as we point out in that list we're discussing in the air power, the big thing in 2010 with air power was everybody got serious about unmanned combat aircraft because they're smaller and cheaper and do the same job.
Right. You don't have to build the redundancies in them.
Yeah.
Dan, could I give another take on this? It's not disagreeing with Jim, but it's another take on the J-20, but not just the J-20 Chinese stealth aircraft by itself. Take a look at what China is doing in terms of trying to develop an integrated military system. Jim's right that they're not building, it's not a huge naval buildup. They started this modernization program though in the 1990s, and you're getting to see these new, as I like Jim's description of them, they are new, but they're austere. At the same time, they're developing these these capabilities. And I've been doing it steadily now for a decade and a half, two decades. And they do have, at least to me, and I've certainly written about this in my newspaper column. Heck, we had a lot of hits on the column that was up on Strategy Page a couple of weeks ago about China's expanding Navy, getting bigger. J-20 fits in to several scenarios where China wants to achieve local air supremacy. That could be over the Taiwan Straits. And understand that the Taiwan Straits was one of the scenarios that the U.S. Air Force was looking at and saying that we need the F-22. Okay? And that was a debate that went on three or four years ago. I would even shift it south and say, all right, China's got tremendous air power compared to everybody else in Southwest Asia. But in a South China Sea scenario, a J-20 type aircraft pretty much seals the deal unless the United States is involved. Move now, fighting over Tibet and the Himalayas is a mess. But we've reported this on Strategy Page before, that the Indian Air Force is now at its Top Gun equivalent, training against Chinese tactics. There's a message in there, not just to the United States, but to the Indians, which gets back to the Navy. Look, you've got to take this with several grains of salt, and we do. And there's some number of things that Jim's written about the Chinese Navy that has this theme running through it. Take it with several grains of salt. Don't jump to the conclusion that the mainstream media does. But the Chinese naval theorists write about the first island chain, well, not really, it's Japan, Taiwan, and then kind of curls into the South China Sea. All right, anybody just look at a map and imagine it. And then a second island chain. Now, this is a little bit more aggressive. Start at Singapore, swing it out around the Philippines, runs right through Guam, and Guam is, where America's day begins, a huge base for virtually everything, and we keep strategic bombers there. Swings up through the Western Pacific, and then comes back to Japan. The Japanese had noticed, and this was in that column I wrote a couple of weeks ago, that they're the fulcrum of both of these island chains, which is one of the reasons, and we write about this, the Japanese have gone into a naval modernization program, but it's all like the Chinese. And I think the Japanese is probably interested in Jim's opinion on this. I think the Japanese are more astute about it in some way than the Chinese, but integrating it with airspace defense, including anti-missile defense. Anti-missile defense, this is something in the report that Jim's referring to. It's going to show up on the Strategy Page by the time our strategy talk is up. It will already be there on the page about the Dongfeng 21. A DF-21D, so-called carrier killer ballistic missile. That fits into an integrated naval, sea, air, space, and sea approach to projecting the power from the Chinese mainland. And so that's, I see pieces that tell me there is an idea behind this, and that is extending Chinese power to that.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of this activity in Chinese military procurement comes from the government basically telling the generals and admirals. This, I guess, we reported on this. You know, this goes back at least 5 years ago. They said, use your imaginations. We cannot match the asymmetric warfare, in effect. We cannot match the Americans at their game. So we have to come up with something else. We mention this a lot in Strategy Page when we talk about Chinese cyber war, which they've been very successful at. Of course, we also mentioned in the article that's going to run tomorrow about Stuxnet being the first true internet weapon. The engineers I've spoken to who have seen some of the code, they ooh and ah, they say, oh man, genius. And if somebody's capable of cranking out more of those, somebody's in a world of hurt. And I expect, the Chinese, as far as I can tell, think it's us or the Israelis. The Chinese like to take comfort in paranoia, so they're blaming us. And that scares the crap out of them. He said, geez, what if they turn one of these things in the other direction? What the hell are we going to, maybe they already have. So, the possible story you're going to see this year is Chinese whole witch hunt looking for Stuxnet. They are very much afraid of this. And what they told their people was, you know, come up with ideas. And somebody came up with the, hey, we can steal the old American Pershing, terminal guidance system that scared the crap out of, the Russians because that Pershing missile could target Russian headquarters. You know, nothing like decapitation. They had the attention of the leadership.
That's the Pershing 2.
The government said, all right, you know, here's the money you need, you know, take the DF-20, 21 and, turn it into a carrier killer. Now, as we pointed out in strategy page, they appear to have put together the pieces, but it hasn't really been tested. So it's unlikely that they may call it operational, just like the North Koreans call their half-assed, nuclear bomb operational. But as a practical matter, it isn't. But that's besides the point. They made the effort. They put together the pieces. They tested parts of it. And if they keep pushing, they could, you know, test the whole thing. But the Chinese are a little gun shy on going the final mile because they've had a lot of embarrassing failures. And, you know, they don't really want any more. So I wouldn't be surprised if they were just holding back on a full-scale test, which would be difficult to hide. You know, we have satellites that are looking for, you know, missile tests and what have you. We still own the waters that they'd be dumping that missile into, own it as far as intelligence reconnaissance and signal of reconnaissance goes. So we'd see it. And I suspect they find it more useful as a completed but untested weapon than as a tested weapon that failed.
Right. Now, one of the things that was interesting about Stuxnet is that it had the ability to jump onto process control computers, and that's the scary thing.
Oh, yes. The thing engineers love about it is the way it is engineered to basically – well, it's basically a piece of artificial intelligence. It's got its orders programmed into it, and it will hide. It will stay dormant, and it looks for a very specific set of process controls, and it will basically stay out of the way until it finds it.
Yeah.
You know, this is real life Tron. I only saw the original one years ago, but as I remember, it was, you know, what computers are really thinking. And as I watched that, I said, you know, now that makes sense. Especially if you dealt with the early computers, PCs, and mini computers. But what Stuxnet is basically a piece of artificial intelligence that looks for a specific target and will look for months and years. And apparently it looked for 6 months at least before it found its way into the Iranian computers that it was designed to locate. And then it sat there apparently for a certain length of time until certain conditions were met and then started subtly messing things up. It was designed for covert operations.
Right.
Which is why people blame the CIA.
Yeah, this isn't people's home desktops like that. These are computers that are controlling anything from manufacturing to oil and gas flow to, I think the Iranian thing was their centrifuges,
right? Their centrifuges, yeah. Yeah, just making them, screwing them up just enough so that it would seem like the Iranian engineers think, well, we must have done something wrong.
Yeah.
It didn't want to look like sabotage.
Well, let's wrap this up by talking about, you know, America's favorite branch of the Army, the infantry, the dog face, the GI, and what his and her challenge has been this year.
Well, there were two things we covered. One was the infantry itself, and the big issue we covered there was weight and equipment. As we've been covering for the last decade, there's been a flood of new gear for the infantry. I mean, everything from new eyeglasses, new flashlights, and we did a thing recently about how a lot of troops are, you can go out and buy replacement parts for your rifle. You can pick your M16 or M4, by buying, you know, new trigger mechanisms. So, you know, for example, that guys that like larger ones, which they have big fingers, so they use a kind of glove that is bigger than the usual, you know, thin glove and what have you. You can do all sorts of things which make them marginally more effective, and it all builds up. But the big thing was weight, because with a heavier armor, which reduces casualties a lot, and increases bravery a bit, all the extra gear, you know, the medical gear, what have you, everybody has a personal radio now. I mean, new stuff that the troops don't want to leave behind. They don't want to leave behind the new medical kit, which is like maybe an extra ounce or two, with the special powder, which will stop massive bleeding if an artery gets shot, which normally was a killer, you know, up until that stuff became available. There's the personal radio, which very few troops want to, you know, dump, you know, leave behind, because it basically puts you in touch. It's like having, you know, constant texting, as it were. And of course, the new armor they don't want to leave behind because it's literally bulletproof. And we basically discussed how there have been many efforts in the last few years to make that stuff lighter and lighter so they can basically still run around and fight. The other thing we covered in a separate section on weapons was all the new infantry weapons, new sniper rifles, new automatic rifles and what have you. But the point we made at the end of it was that what the military is looking for is a replacement for the M16 type weapon. The M16 type weapon, basically a less than 6mm assault rifle that uses lighter, faster moving, you know, ammunition with faster moving bullets. This basically took over in the 1960s. As popular as the AK-47 was, troops prefer the M16. And everybody else in the world, including the inventors of the AK-47, the Russians, they are now into their, I think, third generation of M16-type weapons. But nobody's made a big breakthrough. Everybody's Jim, still basically using an approved M16.
Jim, let me ask you a question, too, about the Marine Corps M27, which is a 5.56 millimeter.
Yeah.
That's being bought, too, because of the
lightness
issue, because it's going to be used to replace M249s
and what we explained was they basically with the M27 they replaced the 5.56mm, you know, belt-fed machine gun, which has been around since the 80s, with a new BAR, automatic rifle, because that's what the M27 is. Now, what it depends on is it hasn't got a replaceable barrel. The troops have to basically practice heat management. In other words, you can't just go firing off. It hasn't got a belt feed, although you can put a 50-round magazine on it and what have you. They're telling the troops, you can have more automatic fire, but you got to manage it. You know, you're Marines. You do not have an endless supply of ammunition. You're not playing a video game here. And I believe, not 100%, because they're only replacing about half or more of the M249s with the M27. But what they've heard from a lot of their troops and a lot of their combat commanders is it would be better if we had a weapon like the M27, lighter, automatic fire, but we don't need a lot of it. When we need it, we need it. And the M27, they believe, and we'll hear in the next year or so, because they're using it right now, whether it works, well enough to justify this new weapon, if this will do it. But unfortunately, this doesn't address the issue that they're still pulling their hair out about, and that is, what about the M16? Because one of the things I point out in the article is that the bolt-action smokeless powder rifle, you know, the original Mauser and the 30-06 and what have you, that weapon ruled the battlefield for half a century, about 50 years, until World War II, when the assault rifles started coming out. In fact, it was in World War I that the Germans invented the first 9mm machine pistol, which was very popular in the last year of the war. They made about 30 or so thousand of them. And, of course, that was the MP-43 in World War II. And, of course, the Russians equipped whole divisions with their PPS and what have you, the 7.62mm rifle, pistol round submachine guns. Right after World War II, the Russians had the AK-47, and the Russians, of course, was like the German Sturmgewehr. So nothing has replaced the assault weapon. I mean, the AK-47 basically ran out of steam after about 50 years. Well, the Sturmgewehr, you know, the Germans did give them credit. They came up with the idea first. The Russians copied it. But nothing's replaced the M16 type weapon, and it's at the end of its rope. And this bothers the military. They say, God, we're so smart. There's been so much progress. Why can't we come up with something better? Which may be, the answer may be, well, there isn't yet. Don't get a heart attack over it.
That's probably a good place to end this, but we can pick this up because there's a lot more to talk about in that piece that Jim's put together.
Yeah. All right. As you mentioned, Austin, our time's up, and we'll talk to you gentlemen next time.
All right,
Dave. Bye.